Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 3rd, 2009. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, home brewer Greg Peach sits in to talk about a branch of the hobby that he's exploring, yeast ranching. Yeehaw! Insert your Western-themed pun here. Yeast ranching is essentially starting a collection of the little critters that you can use to brew up a batch of beer or to share with your homebrew buddies. If you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook. And if you become a fan of the show there, I'll be sending out occasional notices when shows are posted and such as that. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. And we appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. I took gravity readings of the 3 2-gallon batches of barley wine that I'm brewing to take part in the Brew Your Own magazine Basic Brewing Radio Collaborative Experiment that's going on right now. I did that, took those gravity readings this past weekend. You might recall that I pitched 2 grams of dry yeast into one of the 2-gallon batches, 6 grams into another, and 24 into the third. The starting gravity of the little barley wine, by the way, was 1079. And I'm not going to tell you what the gravity was at a week after pitching, but I will say that I was surprised. That's all I'm going to say. I'm planning to bottle this upcoming weekend, so be plenty of time to evaluate, to let the bottle's bottle condition before it's time to evaluate. I hope that you're taking part in the experiment. The deadline to report your data is September 30th, so you still have time. You can check out Chris Colby's blog at byo.com/blogs for details on the experiment procedure. And we're trying to see what varying pitching rates will do to identical batches of wort. And as of right now, I apologize, I don't have the online entry form up yet, but I hope to have that soon, maybe even by the time you listen to this. And you'll be able to find a link to that at basicbrewingradio.com. So take good notes on all of your process right now, and then by the time it's done, hopefully the data form will be up there that you can send us your stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing and seeing and tasting the results of the experiment. A lot of you have asked if we're going to the Great American Beer Festival this year, and I've decided to do something different. I don't want to get burned out on GABF, number one. And number two, I want to spend our travel budget in the best way possible to kind of widen our horizons, you know, to see what's out there in the beer and homebrew world, and to get content for you that you haven't heard or seen before. We've been to the Great American Beer Festival 3 times, I believe. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to go to. So you won't see us there, but next year we'll probably be back. Where we will go this year, Andy Sparks and I are headed to the northwest part of the country next week. Portland, in fact. We're headed up to that area of the world to take part in Hop Madness. If you listen to the archives, you've heard Dave Wills from Fresh Hops talk about the event. It takes place at Willamette Mission State Park. Homebrewers gather there to camp, brew, trade homebrews, and tour a hop production facility. So that should be incredible. It's going to be on Saturday, September 12th. You can go to hopmadness.com to find out more information. If you're in the area, I hope to see you there. Should be fun. Also, we're flying into Portland next Thursday evening, so We'll have a couple of nights in the area to explore the beer culture up there. I'll be tweeting and Facebooking wherever we go. So, again, hope to see you around. And Steve Wilkes and I will be in Tulsa a week later, the 19th. We've been recruited by Desiree and Dave of High Gravity to take part in the Foam Cup. We're excited about that. It's just a short hop over to Tulsa for us, and we hope to see some of you there. Enough travel news. Let's take a look in the mailbag. Got some good letters following our episode last time on the strawberry beer experiment. If you listened to last week's show, homebrewer Matt Troutman put strawberries in at the end of the boil and in the secondary. And we found a hint of some possible infection in the one where the fruit was added in the carboy. It was tasty, but still just kind of a little bit of a plasticky thing going on there. David from Corvallis, Oregon writes, "One thing that I do to prevent a contamination is to add my fruit during high croizen. I mostly use cherries as my fruit and have never had an contamination. In fact, I have a 2-year-old cherry beer that still tastes great." David says, "This also makes sure that there are no leftover sugars to prevent foamers in the bottle. One thing to warn people about is when you add fruit at high croizen, it will foam like crazy. All the simple sugars in the fruit are giving, like giving the yeast crack or something. But all this activity should overwhelm any bugs that may be on the fruit." Well, you talk to Steve Wilkes about adding fruit in the primary. Woo! His peach beer. It was messy, but boy, was it good. Appreciate that, David. Derek from Cedar Rapids, Iowa writes, "You mentioned Randy Mosher discouraging the use of strawberries in beer, but were unsure as to why. In Radical Brewing, page 176, he states that strawberries are almost hopeless, losing all their color and much of their flavor within a month or two. On page 175, he also recommends using either strawberries you picked yourself or frozen, 2 pounds per gallon or more. Over time, the strawberry flavor fades, leaving an orangish-hued, vaguely fruity beer behind." So his recommendations are: be sure of strawberry quality, use lots of them, and drink the beer as young as possible. He mentions nothing of other flavors developing over time. Derek says maybe Matt should continue to test this beer periodically and see if the strawberry flavor continues to fade or otherwise change in character. Thanks, Derek. I do have a copy of Radical Brewing, but I was either too lazy or forgot to look up the reference before recording the interview. Pick your excuse. Probably a little of both. I appreciate your not being lazy, Derek, and sending that in as a reminder. Charles writes in with this: "Having made strawberry mead, adding berries in the secondary, there's a lot of flavor changes from very sour to plastic to funk that fades to a very nice flavor. The overcarbonation is, in my humble opinion," Charles says, "due to, like you said, insufficient yeast in the secondary." Charles says, "I'd recommend if the strawberry beer isn't great right off, wait a long time, and it'll get better if you don't get bombs out of it." So there's something from the opposite side of the fence. Randy Mosher says, "Drink them fresh," and Charles says, "Wait a while." So maybe you save some for both. Drink some now, save some for later. Thanks, Charles. Rob from Wisconsin writes, "As I listen to your podcast about strawberries, the first thing that comes to mind is my winemaking experience. We, my wife and I, have made a few fresh fruit wines, and with those we let the fruits soak in water and Camden tablets for 24 hours to kill any bacteria. This might help with their fruit beers." Thanks, Rob. I did read a note after the interview from Joe in Delaware, Ohio, who said he had done that with one Camden tablet overnight with the fruit, but maybe more than one is needed. Finally, on a different topic from the mailbag, Gail from San Francisco writes, after perusing the archives, Gail says, "I also listened to your older segment with Rick Sellers interviewing Beth Zangary about the Queen of Beer competition, and I wanted to just pass the word that the deadline for QOB is coming up again. Just Google Queen of Beer, It's a wonderful tradition, worth supporting by women brewers, by entering some beers or convincing the women you know to enter a beer. Quick Brewers can still make up a competition beer in time using insights from the podcast on making beers more quickly. And for women brewers who can't have something ready in time this September, starting a barley wine or lambic for Queen of Beer 2010 is a worthy project, too. Enter to win or get top-notch feedback on your brews or both. Thanks, Gail. Appreciate that. We need more women home brewers, definitely. After all, the more brewers, the more beer. After all. One more quick thing. There is a new episode of Basic Brewing Video out there in the most recent episode, otherwise known as episode. I show the damage that Japanese beetles can do to Cascade hops, unfortunately. But there is good news. Steve and I sampled a pale ale that I made with 7 ounces of homegrown hops from the freezer last year's harvest. So, and there's lots of good advice on our Facebook page from brewers who have suffered from Japanese beetles. So check that out as well. Appreciate everybody taking part in the feedback there. To get on with the show for this week, we've done a show in the past on advanced yeast handling, but it's been more than a year since we've done so. On the February 7th, 2008 episode, homebrewer Anthony Fisher did a great job of walking us through the advanced techniques that he uses to culture and even freeze yeast samples. However, I feel it's a topic that's worth visiting again, since yeast is such an important part of our hobby, and we may want to culture our own samples. When I saw a picture that Greg Peach posted of his yeast ranging efforts on our Facebook page, I was very interested in his approach to taming our favorite fungi. Well, Greg Peach, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on.
You are another in a string of interviews that we've had lately of home brewers who also has a background in science, right?
That's right. I'm a veterinarian, so I've spent lots of time in school and doing various science projects and use science in my daily life.
And tell us about your brewing background. What kind of beers do you like to brew, and how long have you been brewing?
I tend to like to brew session-type beers, usually mid- to low-gravity beers, and usually English ale-type things. I've been brewing since probably about 1992, and originally started doing extract batches, and now I am doing all-grain, and it's kind of hit or miss over the years how much I brew. And the last couple of years, I've been brewing more and getting more into it, refining my system and techniques, and getting a little bit more into the technical side of things.
And recently, you started getting into yeast ranching, and you've coincidentally started a blog at the same time. And tell us the address of your blog and why you decided to get into that aspect of brewing.
So the blog is Saccharomyces Safari. It's at Blogspot, and the yeast ranch kind of came about from some discussions with my homebrew club. I think we had a tasting that maybe went a little longer than it should, and we started talking about developing a yeast library and how it might be fun to collect yeast that we could save and reuse later and just, you know, share with each other as a group. And somehow I was the one who decided that that actually was a good idea.
You were sitting closest to the keg, probably.
Apparently.
No, I tweeted out there that I was going to be talking to a homebrewer about getting into yeast ranching and asked for questions. And oh, the homebrewers are a clever lot. You know, there was everything from how big are the lassos to, you know, what kind of saddles do you put on the, you know, I guess a Monday morning is a good time to, you know, bring out the smart aleckiness in the listeners out there. But I got several questions, and the first one that I want to ask is, Big Kahuna Brew asks, is yeast ranching cost-effective or just part of the obsession?
Yeah, it's definitely part of the obsession. It's not a real expensive thing to do, but then again, neither is buying a nice fresh smack pack or vial of yeast. But it's something I started doing mostly because I'm a little bit geeky and have an interest in the technical aspects of things, and just thought I would enjoy doing.
Now, what kinds of yeasts have you collected so far, and what are your goals?
I have collected, I have six yeasts currently that I have cultured, and they're mostly British ale yeasts. I have one Belgian strain, which I actually like quite a bit, and just brewed an IPA off the plate last weekend, and that is coming along quite nicely. But the goals are kind of to just see what I can collect and how many I can keep going, and to be a source for my friends in the homebrew club to see if they want to ever use any, just to whip up a starter for them and share it. And in turn, they have been giving me cultures from their brewing when we get together.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is where are your sources? Where are you getting these yeast strains?
They're so far, everything I have are either White Labs or Y Yeast strains, and we've either been getting them out of a vial as we're opening it, or a lot of them we've taken out of bottles after we've finished one, or out of carboys after the fermentation. So it's kind of been hit or miss, depending on how prepared I am to get a sample.
Mm-hmm. So you can get yeast from several sources.
Yeah, there's yeast everywhere, and it's really the trick is just trying to make sure that you're not getting contamination. So we definitely don't sample out of bottles that we've been drinking directly out of.
There's no telling what you might find there. And that's a question, another question from KG, the free range librarian, whom I follow and enjoy her posts. She says, "How do you keep the bad bugs out when you're collecting a sample?"
That's a good question. The trick is keeping everything as clean as possible. So what I purchased was a small alcohol lamp and just a little metal inoculation loop. And so what I'll do is I can, if I'm getting it out of a bottle of homebrew, I'll flame the lips of the bottle with the alcohol burner, and I'll flame the wire loop until it's glowing red hot, just so anything that might be on there is burned off and dead. And just try to insert that loop down into the dregs of the bottle, and try not to hit anything on the outside of the bottle on the way down, and then streaking it out onto a plate. Or if you're not putting them onto plates and you're doing it just into a wort sample that you have in another bottle or a mason jar, you know, trying to just make sure the edges are sterilized with a flame, and pour carefully, try not to splash it around.
So you can get away with not buying laboratory equipment and such as that, at least at first?
Yeah, my equipment, I got some of the homebrew, or a lot of the different homebrew supply shops carry some of the basic equipment. The alcohol burner is nice. You could really use any flame, but that's just a convenient, cheap, and easy little source of heat that I can set out on my kitchen table and flame it, and some rubbing alcohol from the pharmacy, and I'm pretty good to go, apart from needing my plates. The question about making sure you don't get contaminants in there, that's where I like to use the plates, because then I know I'm getting yeast only, because I can see each individual little colony that I get.
Mm-hmm. So you can, if you go from, say, a bottle of beer or a fermenter or another source into, say, a small starter, mm-hmm. you're not 100% sure that what you've got in there is what you want.
That's right. And I've done that, and that works great most of the time, but you do over time run the risk of something floating in there during your sampling procedure, and at some point you may get a contaminant versus getting things onto a plate. You may get contaminants, but you can see that as a separate colony and then resample your good colonies to purify your source again.
Huh. So before we get too far ahead of ourselves, what are we talking about as far as the basic equipment that you would recommend if we want to get started in this?
The basic equipment, as I mentioned, is a little alcohol burner, inoculation loop, which I like the metal ones. You can also buy disposable pre-sterilized ones, and some petri dishes with a malt agar mix as a culture media, which you can purchase pre-made at a lot of the homebrew shops online, or you can get sterilized plates and just make them up yourself.
And you can either buy glass plates if you've got some way to sterilize them, or you can buy disposable plastic pre-sterilized ones, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So if you don't want to invest in, say, a pressure cooker, or if you don't have access to an autoclave, say if you don't work in an establishment that has one, then
it's very handy.
Yeah, that may be the way to go. So if you've got, say, like a pre-made, agar plate, and you streak your loop across the medium and mm-hmm. let it grow, how can you tell if you've got an infection, and how can you tell the bad stuff from the good stuff just by looking at it?
Well, I mean, the first thing is just looking for anything that's different. So if one thing doesn't look like another, it's probably a problem. So that makes it easy. The yeast colonies are usually white and round, slightly raised off the plate. If you get other molds, you'll tend to see things that look like bread mold, something green and fuzzy that looks like it doesn't belong. And in the bacterial colonies oftentimes will have a more shiny appearance and will just look different than the yeast. So really the nice thing is most of your colonies should look pretty much identical. And if you see something different, you've picked up something.
Do you need a microscope for something like this?
No, it's something that's just visual. Just holding it in your hand, you can look and see if anything looks abnormal. Now, you could potentially have different colonies of different strains of yeast, and they may look the same. So it's possible you could pick up different strains of yeast on the plate, and that might be harder to tell apart without a microscope. But in terms of a bacterial infection or some of the bad stuff you don't want, those are pretty easy to pick up.
Now, if you wanted to, if you didn't want to go the petri dishes and the lab equipment sort of way, is it practical to have sort of a collection or a library of yeasts, in small starters in the fridge?
Oh, sure, that works great too. there's a little bit more chance of picking up some sort of contaminant because you can't see all the various different cells that are in there. You can't see those colonies. But that works great. And you just, you know, can keep using them until you start having problems.
Hmm. What's the viability on, say, a yeast that's on a petri dish and versus one that's, say, in a mason jar or something like that? And you don't freeze yours, right? You just keep yours in the fridge.
I just keep mine in the fridge. I worry about freezing them that I might actually destroy some of the cells and lose viability. But I've had some plates going for probably about 5 months now, and just last weekend we brewed up a big batch, and I actually supplied yeast starters for three of the batches, and I think overnight each one of the ones that I had grown the yeast up for managed to blow its airlock off, so it seemed pretty viable.
Something's going right there. Or horribly wrong.
I was fairly happy in the morning, mostly because it was in my basement and not a big deal to clean up.
So if you streak a yeast sample onto a petri dish, how do you don't throw it into the fridge just then? How do you handle it? Right.
Right. So I'll streak out a sample onto a plate, and that's something I had sort of learned in school how to do, but there's lots of videos on places like YouTube that kind of show you how to do it. It's pretty easy to do once you learn the technique. But I will streak something out and then just set it out. I keep mine in my kitchen because it's nice and warm, and wait until I start to see growth. And usually, probably 4 to 7 days, I will start to see some colonies forming, and once I feel like I've had some good growth and everything looks okay, no contaminants, I will put it in the fridge where it can stay nice and cool and hopefully viable.
Hmm. And is that and that's a good storage solution for you. You got to make sure that it's sealed when you put it in the fridge so that you don't get bugs from all the other food in there.
Yeah, certainly if I was doing this on a commercial basis, my fridge probably wouldn't be the best place for it. But I just wrap my petri dishes in saran wrap, and that so far has been working well for me. I haven't had anything creep in there.
Now, I got another question from Tim in Auburn, Pennsylvania. What's your recipe for a starter to inoculate when you first get these colonies and want to use them from the fridge? You've got a very, very small sample there. How do you build that up into a pitchable amount, and what's your recipe and technique for doing that?
So I will usually make up just a teeny little bit of wort in the 10:30 to 10:40 range, and I have some just small little glass test tubes that I will sterilize, and I'll put about 10 mls of wort into those, and I will harvest a colony off the plate. So I'll just flame my loop, get it sterile, pull the colony off, and add that into my little 10 ml starter, and usually pretty quickly you'll start to see just like a little mini fermentation going on, and can watch a little yeast pellet develop in there. And after a few days, once it looks like it's been building up, then I'll move up into a couple hundred mLs, give that a few more days, and make sure everything looks like it's going well and fermenting happily. And then I'll move up to my final starter size, which is usually between 500 to 700 mLs, give or take, depending on my mood when I make it.
Mm-hmm.
So I will usually try to start about a week before I need it. So that's where it's much easier to go out and buy some, like a snack pack, because you don't need to be quite so organized to get your timing right.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a magic formula where you don't want to overpower your little yeast? If you pitch just a small amount of yeast in a big starter, you're going to get undesirable results, right? So is there a magic formula that you use to kind of figure out how big to step up into the next stage?
I don't have a set formula, but I tend to think I can go up maybe by power of 10. So if I have 10 mLs, I can easily, I think, go up to 100 mLs and potentially then take that to a liter, although I don't do starters quite that big.
Hmm. How long do you think that you can save like a Petri dish in the fridge? And do you think that it would be different if you had like a mason jar with some yeast cake in it? Because Dan in Buffalo is asking, how long can you keep a mason jar of yeast in the fridge? Because he has some Irish ale yeast from last July that he's skeptical of. So how long do you think it's practical to keep some yeast hanging around in the fridge?
Well, I think on the plates, I think, you know, 6 months is probably a good time period. I've noticed on mine, they're starting to get a little bit older. Some of the colonies are starting to get a little big and starting to merge into each other. So sometime soon, I'm going to re-streak some plates just to start new. But they can stay for quite a while on the plates, and I would say most likely they'll last longer than a mason jar, because they're not sitting in alcohol. Mm-hmm. They're just sitting on their little media, sort of slowly working away, but they're not, you know, sort of sitting in their own waste product. So over time in the mason jar, those yeasts are going to be more likely to become dormant and lose some viability, and you know, probably a little more risk of getting an unknown contaminant into that mason jar also. But that being said, if you can grow something out of it and it tastes good, that's great.
Yeah, I can attest that, and I don't know if the listeners have seen discussion on the Basic Brewing video of the zombie Belgian yeast that I cultured up, that was from a few tubes of White Labs yeast that were several years old. If you can find some sludge, you know, some yeast sludge, there may be a few cells in there that you can nurture back to health and get a pitchable amount. But because the yeast has been stressed for that long, you really don't know what you're going to come out with, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it will change over time, and having the yeast on a solid media, you'll stay with more with your original culture than if you have it sitting in a mason jar or an old bottle of homebrew. But change is not always bad unless you're trying to sell it, and then maybe it is.
Well, that's true. You might come up with something that's, that's interesting. Ben from London asks, other than making a starter, how do you check viability?
I think that's really the way to do it, is to make starters. But like I said, I will start with a little 10 ml starter, so it's a pretty easy thing to do. And within a day, if I'm not seeing fermentation, I know I have a problem.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do at that point? Do you just throw the whole Petri dish away, or do you try it again with another sample?
Well, so far I haven't run into that problem, so hopefully I won't. But I would probably look for other colonies on there and see what I could grow up. I guess, you know, I would be worried if I started seeing that my Petri dish looked, that the plate looked dried out, because if it dries out, that's probably going to kill those yeast. But, you know, if it's if it's moist and they look like they have the same appearance that they've had all along, it's probably pretty good. And that's the nice thing about this. If they do go bad, it's pretty easy to get new yeast and start fresh.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one handy thing that this technique can help you with is if you enjoy a particular beer, you know, like a Hefeweizen or something like that that's bottle conditioned, you can get that yeast and have it for yourself, essentially.
Yeah, that's true, and I haven't done that yet, but I've heard about a lot of people doing that, and that's certainly something interesting to do. I'm actually planning on trying to see if I can recover anything from some 15-year-old barley wine that I found hidden away in my parents' basement, and I have no idea what yeast was in it. I'm kind of thinking it may have been a champagne yeast, but that is one of my next little pet projects, to see if I can recover anything out of it and then try to brew with it.
Well, kind of an archaeological expedition there.
it might be.
So are there any tips as to what yeast that you may not want to culture?
I think culturing anything that interests you, go for it. I'm not sure about culturing a Brett. That's not something I've worked with, so I'm not sure how that would work, and you might want to keep that separate from your other cultures to try to make sure you don't have contamination from it. But I think if it ferments, you can probably culture it.
Mm-hmm. I got a question from Tom. Any tips on ranching wild yeast for a lambic or a Berliner Weiss? So a lambic's kind of a different animal, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're probably talking more with a wild fermentation about there probably being a variety of different critters in there, and, you know, maybe a couple different yeasts and maybe even some bacterial fermentations. So I think using a plate technique like I've been doing wouldn't work so well, because those are really designed to isolate single strains. So if you have a multi-strain fermentation, you might be able to isolate each strain out of it, but recreating that fermentation would be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had something like that I liked, that would be one I would encourage someone to try to keep going in a liquid culture, in a mason jar or, you know, a bottle or something along those lines.
Yeah, essentially just pitching the dregs into a starter and letting the starter do its thing, and then sticking it in the fridge and trying to keep that going in sort of the similar way that you're using the plates, right?
Right, right. But that, you know, that would help keep, you know, a variety of different strains going at the same time.
That's,
and that's one I think it might be hard to recreate, because I think your mix would change over time, because some things would be more viable during that storage than others. So I think you probably would experience change over time.
That's a good point. Got a couple of questions about yeast washing. And I've had a little experience with yeast washing, just with sterilized or sanitized water. Have you gone that route?
I've never done that. I've only a couple of times put some fresh warts onto old yeast cakes, and that's worked pretty well. But for the most part, I've always just made up new starters. In terms of culturing the yeast out onto plates, I don't think that washing is really something you need to do, because the washing process is really helping get rid of some of that trub, you know, any hop residue, dead yeast cells, and, you know, with the culture, with the little loop you're using to get it onto a plate, you're not gonna pick up a lot of hop residue. The non-viable cells aren't going to really affect anything, and you're just going to grow up those individual viable cells, and you'll be able to isolate the good ones from any potential contamination. So for culturing it, I don't think the washing's a necessary step.
What doesn't grow is not going to hurt you, and what does grow is hopefully good yeast, right?
On the That's the plan.
Well, I've been able to keep one batch of, I think it was White Labs, California ale yeast going for like 6 or 7 batches of beer by, you know, abusing it in one way or the other, either pitching, you know, new fresh wort on the yeast cake or by washing with water the way it used to say on the White Labs site, but they've taken that page down. It's essentially the technique that they advocated was taking 2 sanitized containers, of course, and then boiled and cooled water that's been refrigerated, and you essentially rinse the yeast back and forth between those sanitized containers, and essentially the yeast that stays in suspension is the good stuff, and the theoretically the stuff that settles in layers at the bottom is mostly either dead stuff or, you know, dormant stuff. So I mean that's the 30,000 feet description of the of the yeast washing technique that I've used. But one thing that that you open yourself up to when you do that kind of thing is that you're exposing your yeast to air more, and you're exposing, you know, every surface, new surface that your yeast solution touches has potential contaminants on it. And so it is kind of adding some risk in there as well. Whereas if you flame a loop and, you know, you do, you scratch it onto a sterile agar solution, you're going to be a bit more safe, right?
Yeah, I think you probably have lower risk with just using the loop, and also with getting it onto a plate. If you do pick up a little contaminant, you can probably separate it out from your good cells. So, you know, if you have a contaminant, you can grab something that looks good and just take that and put it onto a new plate and be working with something pure.
Is there anything that we've missed in the process that you think is essential for somebody who's trying this from scratch?
Well, I think the relax, don't worry, have a homebrew is very important. But really, it comes down to just having, you know, a little bit of an idea of some sterile technique, just, you know, keeping things clean and sanitized and, you know, sterilized if you can. And I do have access to an autoclave, which is nice, but pressure cookers work just fine. And a little bit of research. I had listened to your show, I think last year it was, and there's some good information in the Tech Talk archives. And I got a little booklet from White Labs that I believe is called A Fungus Among Us. and it's pretty easy to do. I was a little bit hesitant at first, but once I got going, I realized it's pretty straightforward and kind of an entertaining way to spend my time.
There you go. For me, it's kind of like all grain brewing, you know. It was kind of scary until I did it and was like, hey, well, that's not so bad.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it is. It sounds kind of scary, but once you start doing it, it's not too big a deal. And, you know, as long as you're not too worried about it, it's probably going to come out okay.
Well, there you go. Words from the wise, I guess. Well, Greg, we will be following your progress on your blog, and I'll put a link out to your blog in the description of this episode out there on basicbrewingradio.com.
Great. Thank you, James.
I appreciate your time, and good luck.
All right. Well, I will keep everybody posted, and we'll see what sort of fun stuff we grow up.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks again to Greg. Once again, I'll post a link to his blog on basicbrewingradio.com in the description of this episode. It'll be fun to follow as he builds up his collection of yeast. And I may get into it too, doggone it. The yeast in the bottom of the last surviving zombie Belgian is calling to me to save them for yet another batch. If you have any brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Homebrewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits on our site. We've got new combo deals, not new combo deals, but we've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've got shirts, including our Go Forth and Flocculate shirt and shirts of different colors. And we're working on another one. Another shirt coming up by award-winning designer, hopefully. So stay tuned for that. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Celestron Skymaster Giant 15x70 binoculars with tripod adapter and Helping Hands with magnifying glass. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. And also, don't forget, we've got the associate links for the American Homebrewers Association and Brew Your Own magazine out there on the site as well. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson down there in Austin, Texas, where they do real ranching around there. Well, not in Austin, but, you know, in Texas. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.